My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schrein and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Farn and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their respective vocabularies. Two marks, if they can tell me the meaning of the following words. Frank Muir, yours is a gallimaufry.
It's a lovely old word. This program could be described,
yes,
as a gallimaufry, could it not? As a kind of hash of half-remembered literature and half-digested history. it's a sort of culinary hodgepodge.
Absolutely right. It can be used either literally, that is, it is a hash or a ragout, or figuratively as a grotesque or inconsistent medley. I think we brought the U into the word. It first turns up in 1551, which is quite early for a word of that kind.
Good word, isn't it?
Yeah, very good word. Anne Scott James, your word is ouch. O-U-C-H, but it's not an exclamation, it's an ouch.
Ouch. But it's not a strip cartoon word, like wham.
Yes, but...
Batman comes on and bumps his head.
You've got the indefinite
and gives
article.
An ouch.
Yeah.
So it's nothing to do with banging or hurting.
No, not at all.
You said
with
it...
apparel.
Apparel,
it's a shirt
a
with
nudge.
The colours one size too small.
Or when you fasten your belt too tight, no, out of vanity and you can't sort of let it out again.
That's it. What you fasten your belt with?
Ah, it's a noosh, is it?
Yes.
A brooch.
That's it.
Or a buckle.
So I'm sorry, after all that very complicated stuff, but this was a French word originally called noosh, N-O-U-C-H-E, and rather like norringe, which the English, with not much sense, turned into an orange. So they said an ouch, but it does mean buckle or brooch or the socket in which you set a precious stone. Two marks well earned. Dennis Norton, a quango.
I've heard of it, but anyway, it's one of these dreadful modern devised words, isn't it? Quang. I would think that's what an air traffic controller would say when he gives clearance for takeoff to a Qantas aircraft.
One mark for that straight away. But it is an acronym, and no. it's a word made up of the initial letters of other words, like radar. If you have a shot at it.
Well, it's what in Australia, a Qantas pilot would describe certain girls as quango. It sounds Australian, well, he's a right quango, and it's it's quite uninhibited and never goes home.
One and a half.
I don't know. It's a mathematical word.
No, it's a very newly coined word. It's not in any dictionary that I've been able to find. Quasi-autonomous, non-governmental organization. Otherwise, jobs for the boys.
Really? They resign.
Dennis Power, yours is hard to pronounce also, and I'll spell it. It's a syzygy. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. Syzygy.
Anything to do with matrimony?
It could be.
It could.
Well, sleeping together.
Put it back to its Greek, Dillis. You'll be able to do this.
Well, there's a very, very polite word for wife or husband, which is syzygos, or syzygy,
yes,
perhaps. I know I'm always being caught out by it because I don't use the polite word. And I get reproached in polite society, but in lower society, it's the other way around. Greeks in villages who want to say your wife always say your woman. You must say your wife. But the polite word for spouse is syzygos. So it's a kind of matrimonial union or something.
Union is the right word. When sun, moon, and earth are in a straight line, that is the time of full or new moon, which is what they call conjunction or opposition, and that's known in astronomical circles as syzygy. It can be used also in mathematical senses or in prosody or the writing of verses. It's a double foot. Well, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you've been given for the last round of all. And Frank, yours is Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea. And yours, Dennis Norton, is Splendor in the Grass. Well, this next round is a round about money. And for 2 marks, in which works of literature do you find the following sums of money having significance in the unravelling of the plot? And if so, why? Beginning with Frank Muir, $1.87.
It's Mark Twain's story, the £10 million note, and it's roughly its present actual value today.
A compatriot of Mark Twain,
an American,
who it sounds like he only had Christian names.
Yes. O. Henry. It's an O. Henry short story.
Yes, it is.
Yes, well, there we are.
It's a story called The Gift of the Magi, and it is by O. Henry.
But The Gift of the Magi...
Yes, the heroine had only that amount of money to buy her husband a Christmas present, so she sold all her long hair...
To buy him...
A watch chain.
And he'd sold the watch chain...
That's right.
The watch.
The watch.
Watch. To buy her a comb for the hair which she'd cut off.
Terrible.
Terrible. Beautiful story. Beautiful.
Anne Scott-James, yours is, I think, more... traditional, 3,000 ducats.
Is it connected with Shylock?
Yes.
Ah, it's the money that Shylock was demanding.
Yes, before he demanded it, he...
Alternative to his pound of flesh. He was going to take the pound of flesh. He didn't get the money.
Yes, that's what I wanted. He lent it first. Absolutely right. It's in The Merchant of Venice. It was a sum borrowed from Shylock by Antonio on behalf of his rather dissolute friend, Bassanio, against the surety of a pound of flesh, 3,000 ducats, and 2 marks. Dennis Norton, 36,000 francs. It is a bit like the first one that went to Frank.
Is it?
Just a bit.
It's not another O. Henry story. It can't be the amount that made Les Miserables miserable because it's what he had to pay for a cup of coffee and a croissant at...
You're on the right kind of it's a French story.
Is it De Maupassant?
De Maupassant.
Yes. That's right. Do you remember...
Is it Le Collier by any chance?
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
Do you remember what happened in this? It's rather charming.
There's a husband, again a husband and wife, and she borrowed a necklace, which she then lost or got stolen or something. And then they sort of lived in penury for several years, gathering the money to pay it back, and then found that it was only an imitation stone.
Absolutely right. It's another rather pathetic, charming story in 2 marks straight away. And Dennis Farr, yours is 1,000 guilders.
1,000 guilders. Browning?
Yes.
Browning.
Well, Pied Piper.
Just explain how it comes into the story.
Well, wasn't it the reward offered by Hamelin Town in Brunswick, by famous Hamelin City? The River Weser, deep and wide, washes its walls on the southern side. It's they offered 1,000 guilders to somebody would rid the town of rats.
That's right. And then they bilked him.
Yes. And so he rid the child's children as well.
The children away.
Absolutely right. Pied Piper of Hamelin, Ronald Browning, the sum promised to the piper for ridding the town of all those rats, and when they refused to pay him, he piped all the local children into a mountain cave where they were lost forever from their parents, though they may have turned up in Transylvania. 2 marks. And now we have a round of recorded poetry, and this is a team round, that is in... two teams of two, as it were. 2 marks. Can you tell me who was the poet and what was the poem of which the following is an excerpt? And Frank and Dillis, your bit is read by Vincent Price.
Desires and adorations, winged persuasions and veiled destinies, splendors and glooms and glimmering incarnations of hopes and fears and twilight fantasies and sorrow. With her family of sighs, and pleasure, blind with tears, led by the gleam of her own dying smile instead of eyes, came in slow pomp.
Well, what was the poem, and who was the poet?
Did you try a poem?
It's a romantic, it's very romantic.
It's right plumb in the centre of the romantic tradition, yes. You can only have two guesses at that. There are only two possible. Hmm. Yes.
Keats.
It's about Keats.
It's about Keats. Well, we've got something.
That was by Shelley.
That's right. Remember the title?
Adonais.
That's right. It's Shelley's Adonais, poem written after Keats died early, and they get their 2 marks. Well, as a supplementary, Frank and Dillis, what's the connection between Percy Bysshe Shelley and Frankenstein?
Ah, well, Shelley had two huge boils, one on either side of his neck. And what happened?
His wife bit him.
That's right. And she wrote a story about
him. And she wrote a story about biting him, yes.
And she was?
Yes. Oh, goodness.
Mary.
Mary. Yes.
Mrs. Shelley.
Yes, he was technically.
Yes, Mrs. Shelley. They did get married.
And she wrote a story called.
Yes, she eloped with him in 1814, married him in 1816. And she was Mary Wollstonecraft.
Yes.
The daughter of Godwin.
She bit her husband.
2 marks. Now, Dennis Norden and Anne Scott James, your excerpt is read by Sir Cedric Hardwick.
And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts. A sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, the round ocean, the living air, the blue sky, and in the mind of man.
Poem and name of author, please.
But the chairman's on put it in the century.
Yes, it's early 19th century. Yes.
Is it Wordsworth?
Yes, it is.
Oh,
yes, dwelling in the 19th
century. That's right, something far more deeply interfused in view of nature. If you could remember the poem, that would be even nicer.
It's not Westminster Bridge, is it?
No.
No, yes. It's down not far from Chepstow.
Oh, Tintern Abbey.
Tintern Abbey.
Pretty good clue there. All right, 2 marks. It's William Wordsworth, lines composed a few miles above Tintern Abbey, which is round about a bit farther away from Chepstow then. And you get a supplementary, Dennis and Anne. Can you complete this much shorter Wordsworthian quotation? The dew was falling fast, the stars began to blink, I heard a voice, it said,
come and have a drink. I don't know. It's minor Wordsworth.
It's minor Wordsworth. I'll give you one.
Two voices there are.
One out of two. The dew was falling fast. The stars began to blink. I heard a voice, it said, drink, pretty creature, drink.
Oh.
A poem to the pet lamb. One more. And now we come to the last round of Frank and Dennis's quotations. And the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. Frank, your quotation was, between the devil and the deep blue sea, which I think is just a popular saying and generally has been traced to any particular author. Frank.
It's a quandary, isn't it? And I'm caught in a quandary at the moment because I don't know what to wear tomorrow. And this is really rather important because tomorrow I've, in my capacity as Lord Rector of St. Andrew's University, I have one of the duties, amongst several others, is to be chairman of the university court, which is the governing body and at St. Andrew's, and I don't know what to wear for it. And I'm in something of a quandary. I'm caught, you know, between the, because I've got, well, I'll tell you what my wardrobe is. I've got what I'm wearing tonight, which, for those listeners without colour radio, it's kind of beige jacket, like an Osborne biscuit without the dimples, with sort of fawn trousers and a bow tie. And up at St. Andrews, with a wisdom beyond my years, I've left 2 garments in case the weather goes wrong when I'm up there. You know, and agrees with what the weather forecaster said, which always upsets everybody. So I've got something for very cold weather and something for very hot weather. And I keep them in the housemaid's cupboard at the Star Hotel there. And it's a duffel coat that I came out of the RAF with. And for warm weather, I've got a T-shirt of a revolting sort of aquamarine blue, which cost 10p. And I got that a year ago at a charity walk, which authors put on in aid of poverty-stricken publishers. And it's aquamarine blue with an even blue, dark blue legend across the front, which said, "Proofreaders rule." OQ? So, when I'm up there, I'm okay if the weather turns very cold or when it turns very hot. And I've got the stuff I'm wearing tonight. And I've got my wardrobe of clothes, which is the usual rubbish one accumulates over the years. What I'm going to wear tomorrow is terribly important because I mustn't wear what I'm wearing tonight. Because I always wear that at every court meeting. And they've got a sweepstake going as to when I will change and wear something different. I happen to know that the chap who's drawn tomorrow's meeting is the university secretary, Mr. David Devine, who's a sterling chap. Well, he's actually a St. Andrew's chap, but he's a very good chap. So it's important that he wins, because the jackpot, I've now learned, has gone up to 88p. Which may not be much after a year and a half, but the way academics are paid, it's a considerable sum in St. Andrews. So I wanted to win this. So you think, okay, I wear something else. But something's gone wrong, you see, because 10 days ago I decided to clean all my wardrobe of clothes in order to select something for St. Andrews. And I stuffed them onto a duffel bag to take them to the dry cleaners, and I forgot to take them. So, lateral thinking. Dry cleaning, you need something that turns round and agitates, a cement mixer. I live in Thorpe. Near us, they're building this sort of mini spaghetti junction, a sort of vermicelli junction there. M25 is going to join the M3. Rushed along there this morning, found a cement mixer, untenanted, put the clothes in, nice and dry, no trouble, wouldn't be dirty by cement, put the clothes in, poured in my powder, got the thing started, and away it went, spinning round and tumbling the clothes. Stood back, everything went wrong. A huge, enormous kind of revolving lorry backed onto it. Chaps appeared, worked the wheel on my cement mixer, pointed its spout upwards till it was like a fledgling sparrow, and this huge revolving lorry extended a beak like a mother sparrow and deposited a hundredweight of wet cement on top of my clothes. Well, of course, you know, the whole thing's now hopeless because my entire wardrobe is now a yard and a half of the M25. So you see, all I've got are the clothes I'm in. I catch the midnight. I'm at the university court tomorrow to chair it. What to wear? All I've got is the two items of rubbish in the housemaid's cupboard in the Star Hotel at St. Andrews. What a decision. What am I going to wear? I'm torn between the duffel and the cheap blue tea.
And now we go on to Dennis Norton and his was Splendor in the Grass, which comes again from Wordsworth and his poem Intimations of Immortality. Dennis.
Field marshals, admirals of the fleet, air vice marshals and field officers of the NATO Combined Operations Joint Chief of Staffs. Honoured as I was to receive your invitation to deliver this year's lecture on neglected feats of military heroism, I must admit to some surprise at being invited. I say surprise, not just because you could have invited the Lord Rector, But because the only other time that I've ever found myself summoned to the presence of so many high-ranking officers was during the last war. It was some 10 minutes or so after General Blood and Guts Patton had fallen into one of the latrine trenches I'd been digging. That sharply etched memory, however, only spurred my determination to find a suitable, neglected feat of military heroism for you. And to that end, I set myself the task of reading through the entire section labelled Military History in my local library. Now, this fortunately did not take as long as I had feared, because all the section turned out to consist of was a copy of The Wooden Horse and something called Bawdy Barrack Room Ballads. Happily, though, the title of Mr. Williams' excellent escape story did yield me my subject, because the neglected feat of military heroism I would like to recall to you today is the one that took place inside the original wooden horse, the one by which the ancient Greeks gained final victory in their altercation with the Trojans. You see, although the employment of this novel instrument of war has frequently been acclaimed in song and story, the people to whom no tribute has ever been paid are the actual Greek soldiers who had the job of sitting inside that wooden horse for 3 days. Let me try, therefore, in this short lecture, to call on my own service experiences to try and reconstruct their agonizing ordeal. First, their non-commissioned officer would have had to brief them. This platoon has been chosen for the honor of pulling off a stroke that could finally end this 10 years of war and return us all to our wives and loved ones. Or both. So, let me show you the stroke that I have mentioned. All right, Corporal, whip them dust sheets off it. And there it is.
Oh, stone me. What is it, Sarge?
What do you mean, what is it, Sarge? If you wore your helmet straight, Epidaurus, you would see what it is. That is an horse. And they are going to call it the Horse of Troy.
Horse of Troy?
The Horse of Troy. What is going to be filled with something. And you know what that wooden horse is going to be filled with, Epidaurus? He's going to be filled with you. All of you. So on a command, enter horse. I want to see you filing in there in alpha, beta order. And I want you to sit inside within there until further orders. Oh, wait a minute, Sarge, how? I mean, where do we enter it? I mean, do we get in, like, through the mouth? No, you do not get in through the mouth. Well, where then? Hey, Sarge, you're not going... No, we are not. You will enter through the trapdoor what has been cut in its midriff. Now, no more from you, Epidaurus. I'll be up in front of the colonel before you can say Agamemnon. And that, gentleman, was the start of their heroic ordeal. And what history has neglected to record is what it must have been like under that broiling Trojan sun for 20 men to sit cooped up for 3 days within a wooden equine construction. Hey, Sarge, shh. Keep the voice down. You want the Trojans to tumble us? What is it? It's Epidaurus, Sarge. What about Epidaurus? He's got one of his tummies. Oh, no. Oh, God, no, not in here. Hang on, Epidaurus. Attention, everybody. Can I have your attention, please? Is there a doctor in the horse? Try and picture it, gentlemen. Discomfort, heat, hunger, thirst, enforced silence, absolutely no ablutions facilities or naffy wagon. And they were not the only privations suffered by this gallant band during their 72-hour incarceration, because it would ill behove me to conclude this tribute without making mention of the worst agony they had to endure, the one that no historian has taken note of. Because what has always been forgotten, gentlemen, is this. They were Greek soldiers. And everybody knows what uniforms Greek soldiers wear. That short, flimsy, white skirt. Now, if you'll just remember that the seats on which they were obliged to sit all that time were made of wood. Well, gentlemen, if you can imagine your own practically bare flesh shifting about on rough, unpolished wood for 3 days, well, gentlemen, your private and ever-present agony is not going to be Wordsworth's splendor in the grass. It's going to be splinter. Thank you, gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story, but Dillis Bower and Frank Muir win this week's contest. Thank you very much.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Bower, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longman. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.